Now let's go to the Dude Maker Hotline and say hello to our regular Tuesday guest from the Lepanto Institute at L-E-P-A-N-T-O, lepantoinstitute.org, where you can sign up for Michael's newsletter and also be the first to know that new investigative journalism from the Lepanto Institute is about to be published. Here's our friend Michael Hitchburn. Hello, Mr. Hitchburn with an O. How are you?
Mr. Church with a U. I'm doing great.
Our young intern, Jakub, posted our Lepanto Institute Minute last week and spelled Hitchburn. He got it all right, except he had a U for the O.
Oh, but he also added a T, which my name also doesn't have.
So I didn't catch it until after it had been published, but I ultimately caught it and corrected it. And we're all good now. So I hope we're all good now. So there's a lot happening out there today. First of all, what is this story that you were telling me about via email about? Did Pope Francis write something? Was this another press conference on Vatican I? What's this latest controversy?
Yeah, so Pope Francis published a document. It's an apostolic exhortation, the title of which is Gaudete et Exultate, which means rejoice and be glad. And the whole apostolic exhortation is on holiness. Or at least it's supposed to be.
It's supposed to be.
Yes. And, you know, he goes through, and, you know, the first chapter actually has a few nuggets that are worth reading. But, unfortunately, there is an entire chapter, the whole entire second chapter of this thing, is devoted to what he calls two false forms of holiness. And he talks about Gnosticism and Pelagianism. But what he does when he defines these two things, he gives the ancient definitions for each of these. For instance, Gnosticism, he says, Gnosticism presumes a purely subjective faith whose only interest is a certain experience or a set of ideas and bits of information that are meant to console and enlighten, but which ultimately keep one imprisoned in his or her own thoughts and feelings. Okay, fine, that's the old definition of Gnosticism, and he talks about, you know, what the Gnostics did in the ancient times. All good. But what he does is he then takes that definition and he applies it to what he says are modern renditions of Gnosticism. And these modern iterations are a complete and total shifting of the goalposts. Because he then says that people that are modern Gnostics, he gives a few examples. He says, let me see if I can find the exact wording here. I'm skimming the image here, but what he goes into, you know, modern Gnostics are people that hold to laws or hold to rules or hold to old traditions, maybe. And ultimately, what it winds up being is a big pointed finger at people that say that there is such a thing as a moral norm.
Oh.
There is such a thing as a moral absolute.
Not that.
Is such. Oh, yeah. I mean, those people are bad Gnostics, you know. So it's a huge problem. And you know, fortunately, I don't know. The way he puts it, he couches everything. It could seem that. We may see that. You know, it's not that he's giving an absolute definition, but he's certainly putting a little, he's injecting just a little bit of doubt into the minds of the reader so that they can say, oh, I see. He's talking about those traditions. He's talking about people that love the old Latin mass.
Ah, those people, though. You trads, you.
Yes. So, you know, it's incredibly frustrating because he winds up citing himself throughout the entire document. I mean, he very rarely cites anybody else, but he's rehashing a lot of his old homilies and a lot of his statements at universities and things like that. It, you know, we're jabs. at people of a traditional mindset, or even more to the point, people who say, gosh, you know, maybe we shouldn't be giving communion to people that are in objective mortal sin.
What a novel thought, right?
Well, yeah. Anyway, he goes through, and in his definition of Pelagianism is even worse, because I really, the way I read this, I'm looking at it, and I think that it's going to be a stepping stone to actually declaring people that are holding to tradition and absolute moral ideals as heretics. Just watch. It's going to happen. Because at one point he actually, he gives the old definition of Pelagianism, and then he says, you know, there's a problem that's arisen in modern culture. And he said that, here we go. He said that this expression in a variety of apparently unconnected ways of thinking and acting are an obsession with the law, an absorption with social and political advantages, a punctilious concern of the church's liturgy, doctrine, and prestige. Who could he possibly be talking about there?
I have no idea. Mm-hmm. We might have to call Inspector Clouseau out on this job.
I know. and then, you know, like I said, there are nuggets in it that are fine. I mean, chapter 3, he goes through the Beatitudes, and he gives a pretty good brief summation of each of the Beatitudes in terms of holiness. You know, this is how you can understand the Beatitude and apply it to holiness. But a lot of it is predicated on this idea of action, specifically social action. In fact, several points throughout this document, he goes out of his way to say that, you know, holiness is not something that can be sequestered away and hidden. It's not found in, you know, people going off and being silent and being isolated from the rest of the world, which would seem to preclude the hermits, the cloistered, you know, people or even people that are infirm, people that are incapable of going out and doing social action.
Traditional wacko Catholics that attend things like silent retreats.
Yeah. Exactly. He very strongly castigates the idea of anybody that thinks that they can find holiness in their own, in contemplation of themselves, not of themselves, but by themselves, without any social action. He's almost is saying, and he doesn't quite go this far, but he's almost saying that the only way you're going to find holiness is in aiding the poor.
Or in, now, is it in this document where we get this proclamation that, or whatever it is, statement that I keep saying, seeing all over the news, that his holiness says that immigrating refugees is the highest form of charity?
He doesn't go so far as to say that, but what he does is he equates social justice, all the social justice. He gives the seamless garment argument.
Okay.
In this paragraph 101, and this got picked up by the New York Times, in paragraph 101, he says, the other harmful ideological error is found in those who find suspect the social engagement of others, seeing it as superficial, worldly, secular, materialist, communist, or populist. Now, I just want to pause right there because it's important to look at the different terms that he uses. He's not talking about social programs that are predicated on the church's interaction with the world, where you would have a Catholic, a convent that administers to the poor, or a particular religious order that administers to the infirm in hospitals, or a particular Catholic ministry that administers to the imprisoned. He's not talking about those. He's talking specifically about government programs. So he says that there's an error where where those who view these programs with suspicion, seeing them as superficial, worldly, secular, materialist, or populist. There are several problems with this. One, it completely dismisses the idea that there is such a thing as communist, populist, materialist, secular, and worldly applications of those particular programs, government programs, or even a socialist heretical infusion of humanism into those programs so that they divorce charity from evangelization, which is the number one mark of the church. But it also, when you look at the specific words that he uses, he's not talking about any good programs that are created by the church. He's talking specifically about government programs. So now we have an issue, because if it's harmful to view government programs with that kind of suspicion, then where does the church fit in? Where do we have any room for the church enacting true charity rather than philanthropy, which is what this is? But I go on.
Okay.
He says, or they relativize it as if there are more important matters, or the only thing that counts is one particular ethical issue or cause that they themselves defend. Our defense of the innocent unborn, for example, needs to be clear, firm, and passionate, for at stake is the dignity of human life, which is always sacred and demands love of each person, regardless of his or her state of development. Equally sacred. So now we're talking about equal footing. Equally sacred, he says, however, are the lives of the poor, those already born, the destitute, the abandoned and the underprivileged, the vulnerable, infirm, and elderly exposed to covert euthanasia, the victims of human trafficking, new forms of slavery, and every form of rejection. We cannot uphold an ideal of holiness that would ignore injustice in a world where some revel, spend with abandon, and live only for the latest consumer goods, even as others look on from afar, living their entire lives in abject poverty. Now, who do you think he's talking about when he says people that are consumed with consumer goods while others look on from afar, living lives of abject poverty? I don't think that he's talking about, you know, your neighbor and the people that you encounter on a day-to-day basis. He's talking about people who actually go and purchase goods for whatever reason. And then while people in other countries on the other side of the planet are starving, are, you know, in poverty and so forth. Now, I'm not trying to take away from the problem of poverty in other countries.
Okay.
I'm not. But there is a serious problem with telling people who are trying to raise their families, men who are the fathers of households, that they are just as responsible for taking care of people in countries on the other side of the planet as they are in taking care of their own families, as they are in taking care of the poor people in their own communities.
Now, I was just going to interject. Michael Hitchburn is with the Lepanto Institute at lepantoinstitute.org, our special guest every Tuesday here on the Mike Church on the Crusade Channel at crusadechannel.com. Michael, let's just pause and try to go one piece at a time. This flies in contravention to what you and I know and what almost all the panelists, if not all the panelists, from the International Conference on Population Control know, and that is this. There is no person that is living in poverty, for the most part, unless they've been subjected to it by A, an oligarch, B, a despotic tyranny, or C, a conflagration of first world powers that conspired with the first two to bring it about. And who is it that has their hands in that cookie jar?
Catholic Relief Services, Catholic Campaign for Human Development,
USCCB.
Yeah. Aid agencies.
So the point is, folks, if you're listening to this and you're going like, well, it doesn't sound to me like this and that, but you have to understand. And people from Nigeria will tell you this. People from Zaire will tell you this. People from all these countries where they're allegedly poor, in South America where there is despotic socialism and, if not outright, anarchy, they'll tell you this. They're not poor because they lack resources or there's no food growing nearby or there's no livestock or the water's poisoned or whatever the case may be. They're poor because they have, A, no access to laws and equal protection of the laws. B, they have no ability then to actually lift themselves out of poverty, which they would happily do if the government and other relief agencies would just get out of the way. And C, this is a rinse and repeat cycle. People in the first world keep throwing money at it because you hear things like what the Holy Father just said, and think that you're aiding and assisting the impoverished. You're not. I beg anyone that thinks like this, watch Michael Mather Miller's movie. I don't know if you've seen it yet, Michael. Poverty, Inc. This is all explained in great detail, and it shows you the trillion-dollar poverty industry that is so entrenched and has got its tentacles into almost every government in the world. Unfortunately, now it appears also that his tentacles extend inside the Vatican.
Yeah. No, those tentacles do extend inside the Vatican, especially. I mean, I've researched Caritas Internationalis and its affiliate groups all over the world, and it's very clear that there is an objective among those organizations toward globalization. In fact, I have on hand a document that was written by Caritas Internationalis in 2004 where they said specifically that they are seeking a globalist redistribution of resources. That's their purpose. That's why they exist. That's socialism. This is international communism at its worst. Caritas Internationalis just happens to be on the governing body of an international communist organization, so that's not surprising.
Now, somebody has posted this in our chat room at MikeChurch.com, which you're all invited to come and join. There is a summary of what we're talking about here, which is Pope Francis's latest. Do we call this an encyclical?
It's an apostolic exhortation.
Okay, so it's not an encyclical.
No.
Gaudete et exaltati, which, as Louis Verrecchio says, if you put Gaudete et exaltati together with Evangelii Gaudium and Amoris Laetitia, you get 130,000 words. I don't think the entire New Testament is 130,000 words, for heaven's sake. Now, this is what Verrecchio says about this. As for Gaudete et Exaltati, which is a service to readers, I endure it so you don't have to. That's what Michael Hitchburn did. He read it. So you guys listening out there or watching on YouTube or on Facebook Live didn't have to endure it. Also finds its true purpose in Amoris Laetitia, namely to expedite its acceptance and implementation throughout the universal church. With its true aim defined here, I will offer readers an overview of part 3 of the Bergoglian trilogy. And then he said, this is a lengthy post. And you just mentioned this, Michael, Louis Verrecchio. As with every diabolical initiative, Gaudete et Exaltate contains any number of true and even laudable statements. The most notable can be found in Articles 159 to 163 of the text, which deals with the reality of the devil as a real personal figure. Let's have a sidebar here. So if the devil is a real and personal figure, doesn't the devil have to have a home? Wouldn't that home be called hell?
One would think.
So this would kind of undo the Scalfari controversy last week. It also cites sacred scripture and speaking of how the unguarded tongue set on fire by hell sets all things ablaze. And that's from James 3:6. This portion of the text will likely dominate neocon headlines, especially given the latest Scalfari interview scandal. But what Verrecchio says here, and I don't know if you've had a chance to consider this, but Verrecchio says that that Amoris Laetitia was written in the first stages of the Pope Francis's pontificate. It wasn't released because it had to have the way paved for it by Evangelii Gaudium so that certain things could be known and they could be accepted and they could be digested and then could start to become part of the revolution in Catholic thought, if you will, so that when Amoris Laetitia came out, people went, of course that makes sense. Of course that should follow. And now we get this Gaudete et Exaltate, which, as Michael is informing us, is just another attempt, it seems, to frame many very well-intentioned people who believe that they're pursuing a holy death and a blessed eternity by taking the sacraments seriously, taking the tradition that gave us the sacraments and the defense of the sacraments, and acting as I thought we were taught that we should, as members of the Church Militant. But apparently, you're not a member of the Church Militant if you're not agitating your government to import every Hades-forsaken individual that can be imagined from the third world created by the criminal class and the first world. I'm so confused. Wait a minute. Maybe that's the purpose. Maybe I'm supposed to be confused, Mr. Hitchburn.
I'd like to think not, but unfortunately, you know, in reading this document, and he cites Evangelii Gaudium rather extensively. One thing that I found disturbing, I mean, he also cites Hans Urs von Balthasar.
Ugh.
Von Balthasar,
no.
who is a disaster in and of himself. He also cites Cardinal Carlo Martini. Now, I don't know if you know who Cardinal Carlo Martini is. He died in 2012. He was also one of the leaders, if not the leader, of the St. Gallen's Mafia. And he is a very heavily reputed Freemason. In fact, after his death, a bunch of Masonic sites started talking about how he was a member of the Freemasons. And he gets cited in this document as well. So it's definitely of dubious nature. The object, as far as I can tell, seems to be focused on going after people of a traditional Catholic moral liturgical mindset, saying that those people are not seeking holiness, but only those who are looking for the God of surprises. Those are the ones who seek holiness. And it's fascinating to me because he completely undoes this entire document when I think it's paragraph either 11 or 26.
Okay.
He cites St. John of the Cross, and he says, let's see if I can find it real quick. So he says, we should not grow discouraged before examples of holiness that appear unattainable. There are some testimonies that may prove helpful and inspiring, but we are not meant to copy, for that would even lead us astray from one specific path that our Lord has in mind for us. In other words, you're not supposed to copy the lives of the saints. The important thing is that each believer discerns his or her own path. That's a problem. Maybe you should discern what God is calling you to do and what specific function you're called to in life, but there is only one path to holiness, really.
Okay.
And that's believe in the Gospels and follow me, right? That they bring out the very best of themselves, the most personal gifts that God has placed in their hearts, rather than hopelessly trying to imitate something not meant for them. We are all called to be witnesses, but there are many actual ways of bearing witness. Instead, or indeed, when the great mystic, St. John of the Cross, wrote his spiritual canticle, he preferred to avoid hard and fast rules for all. He explained that his verses were composed so that everyone could benefit from them in his or her own way. For God is communicated to some in one way and others in another. Now, if we were talking simply about different modes of spiritual growth, I would agree. I think that that's absolutely right. But in the context of the greater exhortation, that's not what he's talking about.
Right, right, right.
And then when you think about what he said there, how we don't want to have hard and fast rules and we don't want to make sure that everybody's a cookie-cutter copy of everybody else, what does he do? Throughout the rest of the thing, he goes in, talks about how, well, you can't have these Pelagians who are attached to these rules, and you can't do this, and you can't do that. Well, you're just now establishing rules, but I thought we did away with rules.
And they have the biggest problem with dogma. Michael Hitchburner of the Lepanto Institute is my guest on the Dude Maker Hotline here. If you have a question for Michael or for me on this subject here, the latest apostolic exhortation issued by Pope Francis, this one entitled Gaudete et Exultate. You could give us a call, 844-527-8723, or you can go to my website. It's Mike Church, MikeChurch.com, and join our live chat, and you can put your question in there. Be happy to answer it. I just so happen to have, because most of this is aimed, and there has been a campaign and a war going on for the past 150 years against what you and I call dogma.
Mm-hmm.
Dogma has gone from being a beautiful, cherished, defended, noble, and necessary part of Christendom and thus of the Christian tradition and certainly of the Catholic Church and the Catholic faithful to now becoming a four-letter word let me give you an example, trad.
Yeah.
Trad, the four-letter word that shall not be mentioned and upon which penalty of death or excommunication may come afterwards. But dogma is a good word. Russell Kirk explaining this, and this is a reprint from Modern Age, winter 1978, Modern Age, way back in the 1970s, Russell Kirk was trying to explain to people, no, dude, dogma is not a bad thing. Dogma is a good thing. You guys are idiots, and you're not traditionalists, and you don't know what the Hades you're talking about. Russell Kirk, author of The Conservative Mind and many other brilliant pieces about how to restore the order or what the order should be. And by the way, Russell Kirk never wore his Catholicism on his sleeves because he didn't have to. If you read Kirk, it's like reading J.R. Tolkien. I mean, Tolkien, after the fact, said, well, you know, maybe I didn't even know that I was writing a Catholic allegory in Lord of the Rings, but I most certainly did. So the Holy Ghost is at work here, and you don't always have to, by affirmation, explain these things. And I think Kirk is one of those writers that falls into that category, as does his muse or one of his neophytes now, who is a very learned man worth reading, and that's my friend Brad Berzer at Hillsdale College. Here's what Russell Kirk wrote in part. Now listen to this. Maybe we should apply this to Gaudete et Exultate. Quote, all societies in all times have lived by dogmas. When dogmas are abandoned, the social bonds dissolve swiftly or slowly, and the open society ceases to be a society at all, giving way to a new order, Novus Ordo. Get it?
Mm-hmm.
The successor society may be imposed upon a people from without, or it may arise from within the decadent civil social order, which has lost its principles of coherence. But the succeeding domination, whether it be harsh or gentle, supplants the old order precisely because the people of the new order believe in some body of truths, and the people of the failing order do not. So Kirk wasn't talking about the church. He was talking about American society and American government and about how the dogmas, limited government, and basically Catholic social teaching, subsidiarity and solidarity, people stop believing in them, start believing in welfare and non-government organizations and USCCB or whatever the case may be.
ultimately flee away from the dogmas that are necessary for a little r lowercase Republican society to be a lowercase Republican society. Kirk couldn't possibly have known in 1978, see, what's that, 22 and 18, 40 years ago, that he was actually writing about what was going on inside his beloved Holy Roman Catholic Church. But that describes it perfectly, doesn't it? So there's those of us who are now clinging to this four-letter word, dogma, who are basically now trying to, they're trying to push us to the margins. Is that what's going on here?
I think so. I think so. In fact, if you look at paragraph 43 in Gaudete et Exultate, he says, "It is not easy to grasp the truth that we have received from the Lord, and it is even more difficult to express it. So we cannot claim that our way of understanding this truth authorizes us to exercise a strict supervision over others' lives. Here, I would note that in the church there legitimately coexist different ways of interpreting many aspects of doctrine and Christian life."
Well, then it's not doctrine. It can't be. If you can interpret it how you want, then it's not a doctrine.
Right. Well, you know, different ways of interpreting aspects. So we're not even talking about, I mean, you know, ultimately one could ask, what does this even mean? And when you start looking at how he takes the definition of Gnosticism, completely and totally empties it of its meaning, and then reinvents what a Gnostic is in a modern sense and calls them neo-Gnostics, and does the same thing with Pelagians, it's amazing to me that the definition of the neo-Gnostic and the neo-Pelagian wind up being pretty much the same definition. But they in no way resemble the ancient counterparts that they're supposed to be connected to.
Now, as an example, those of you that are going like, well, you're kind of confusing me, guys. Well, let me give you an example of doctrine not being doctrinal. Does that mean, then, that I can go to a Jewish Seder and get a piece of, quote, consecrated, close quote, unleavened bread, and, well, all you said was it had to be consecrated and unleavened, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that Eucharist? No, the doctrine says no. Yeah. A priest has to do it. Well, that's just your interpretation. Who said a priest? Where'd you get that from? Well, you know, it was in one of the Desert Fathers said it. They started doing it immediately after the Pentecost. Yeah, but Jesus, that's not in the no, man, that's not in the Bible. I mean, this is Protestant nonsense here.
Right. And it seems like what he's trying to do is do away with almost 2,000 years of Catholic theological moral development and definitions, and hit the reset button going all the way back to the beginning and saying, well, you know, there first arose in the church this problem of Gnosticism. So we're going to start from that point and start redefining things and start reestablishing what holiness is and what, you know, what we have to do in order to have to do or not do in order to attain salvation, and what salvation is. At the end of the day, it's Molinism. It's this question of whether we are saved by virtue of grace in how we act and how we attain it through our actions and our compliance with grace, or whether grace acts on us, we act in a it's kind of a technical point, but it's an important one, because at the end of the day, the applicable aspect of it is a Molinist would say, you see, a Thomist says that if you are in a state of sin, but you're unsure, it's better to go to confession. You'd better go to confession first and then go to Holy Communion in order to make sure that you aren't committing a sacrilege, so that you're in a state of grace. You're following the precepts and the rules and the steps.
Makes sense to me.
Says,
right.
It makes sense to me, too. But a Molinist says that the way grace acts on the individual, if you are in doubt, go ahead and go to communion and then immediately find a confessor so that the grace can act on you while you are in that state of doubt. That's a very dangerous thing to do. That's like saying, well, you know, if you're in doubt about whether you're going to step on a mine in this minefield, better to go running through the field than to stand where you are and wait for someone to rescue you.
Let me see if I can trip a few of these off just to prove that there are mines here.
Exactly.
Well, I have to say that, and anyone that takes the point of view that Michael gave in the latter instance and not in the former instance, I have to say that, does that apply in the world outside of the church? And the answer is no. There's no example of that that's prudent in the world outside the ecclesiastical one. Why in heaven's name would you think that it would apply inside the ecclesiastical one? If it doesn't work outside of it, God being the author of the natural world, God being the author of natural laws, that all beings, whether they're animate or inanimate, all created beings, all created entities, have to obey sans a miracle. Why would anyone think that if it didn't work out in the secular world, that it would work inside the ecclesiastical one, especially barring some sort of a grace or a virtue coming to bear on it? I mean, this stuff is so counterintuitive. But I tell you, Michael, you can get away with this with a laity that is so confused, that's never been properly catechized, and quite frankly, doesn't know the faith from the proverbial hole in the ground. They only know what they've been told. And I don't think that that's all their fault. So I don't like blaming the faithful for this.
I agree.
No, I got to lay the blame for this squarely on the prelates and on our priests and on our bishops. You know, a friend of mine's in the Archdiocese of Lincoln, Nebraska, and she said that the bishop took a whole page newspaper ad out, imploring Catholics in his diocese to go out and vote again for this repeal of Nebraska's death penalty laws, saying that the death penalty is contrary to Catholic teaching. And she was livid. And she was explaining to people that she goes to church with, no, it's not against Catholics. It never has been. But yet they were insistent. You're the one that's out of order. You're the weirdo. You're the wacko. You're the one that doesn't know. I had a conversation with someone about this yesterday. You see, this is how the devil and this is how confusion works. You plant the seed. There's no one around to correct the false information that's now been put into your system here. And then it's able to germinate. And sin being what sin is and error being what error is, you can only get error from error. So if you start trying to reason that an error, like the church has always been opposed to the death penalty, that is correct, well, then your mind in pursuing that error is going to produce another error, and you're going to call it reasoning or justice or justification. That's how this stuff works, and this is why it's so dangerous and why there have been countless councils called to put down things like this. But here you have a bishop in an otherwise very conservative diocese out there sowing the seeds of error, and people just say yes because he's their prelate, and there's no one. It doesn't seem as there that as though there's anyone there to correct the error.
I agree. I completely agree. I mean, this idea of telling somebody that if they think that they might be in a state of mortal sin, but they're not entirely sure, that they should just go ahead and go to communion first and then go to confession is like, you know, if somebody winds up somehow in possession of tens of thousands of dollars, they aren't sure if it actually belongs to them or not. So they go ahead and they take that money and they deposit it in the bank, and then they go to the cops in order to say, I'm not sure if this money was mine or not. And the cops say, well, you stuck it in the bank. Obviously, you thought it was yours. And no, it isn't yours. So now you're going to prison.
844-527-8723. It's Mike Church Show here on the Crusade Channel, King Size Truth from radio size speakers with my friend Michael Hitchburn of the Lepanto Institute. You can sign up for Michael's newsletter at LEPANTO, that's LepantoInstitute.org. It's free of charge and don't cost nothing. Someone else posted this in our chat room here. Talk about confusing. This is, I guess, article number 59 from Gaudete. I'm not looking at the title now. Gaudete et Exaltate. Quote, once we believe that everything depends on human effort as channeled by ecclesial rules and structures, we unconsciously complicate the gospel and become enslaved to a blueprint that leaves few openings for the working of grace. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? Can you translate that for me? Can you put that into English? Can you put that into Catholic for me?
I don't speak modernist. So,
I don't speak modernist, but if I did, what is it supposed to mean?
Once we believe that everything depends on human effort as channeled by ecclesial rules and structures. Now, here's the problem. And this is one of the big problems with the way that Pope Francis writes and he structures things. He uses proper definitions in the one sense, but then extends it beyond its original meaning. And that's very evident right here. Once we believe that everything depends on human effort, period.
Right.
If we were to just stop there, then the rest of the sentence makes sense. Once we believe that everything depends on human effort, we unconsciously complicate the gospel and become enslaved to the blueprint that leaves few openings for the workings of grace. That is an absolutely true statement. The problem lies in the fact that he has this clause, as channeled by ecclesial rules and structures. Therein lies the problem. Therein he is complicating the issue because those are not human efforts. Ecclesial rules
Bam-o.
And structures come from the Holy Catholic Church, which was guided by the Holy Spirit. So no, we're not talking about human effort. But that's exactly what he does. He complicates the issue by mixing metaphors and combining definitions so that the original meaning is eradicated. And then he establishes something new.
So I'm not sure if you have heard the Catholic air raid warning siren. Have I played that when you've been on the show?
No.
Oh, you got to hear this. This is all about it, folks, here. Stand by. These are things you're not supposed to hear, this Catholic doctrine. So proceed immediately to a truth-resistant shelter. Go ahead.
A truth-resistant shelter, yes. I don't really know what else to say. I don't want to impugn the Pope and say that he is doing this intentionally because I don't know what his intentions are, but I do want to say that I think that what we are experiencing are the end result of a muddled theological ideal that comes from modern theological teaching. When you start citing people and a lot of the other modern theologians, you're going to wind up with a muddled theology because their entire theology is muddled to begin with. And if you're going to dispense with the paths that were worn by the saints, and Pope Francis is right when he says that there are many paths that we can follow with regard to spirituality. This is true.
Sure.
You can follow an Ignatian spirituality. You can follow the spirituality of St. Therese of Avila. You can follow the spirituality of St. John of the Cross. You can follow the spirituality of Thomas a Kempis. Okay, all of these are different paths that have been worn by the saints towards sanctity. That's how you follow them. It's not like you're trying to determine your own path by navigating the dangerous waters of the world without any headlights. But that seems to be what he's implying here by saying, well, you have to find your own way, and you have to just kind of think of things as they go and let the Holy Spirit work within. Why would you do that? That's like telling somebody to go, you know, sail across the ocean in a rowboat without a life jacket and without any kind of buoys and lighthouses or even a ship ahead of you showing you the way. You know, why would you tell somebody to drop their compass and map and try and figure out the way on their own?